تعب منا اللي فات مش صرت انا بيعت منا كل شورتك تنور افتكر فينا لوليت تادي الجزيرة عش السم دهال سوا في القلوب لفنا راسنا في كل هولما لتادي اتذكرنا من الفروة دال كريم دراينا نمنو في الفلوس ونقيموهم تبتنا سوا من الماضية تسليم اسمك ليمنا كل متى نسيهولك زمي دينا مرسوسة في ديك امشي معنا في الطريق تحيتنا بشنبات نسلوهين يا الكل هديك جنس لي جرب الاوج دور الجراية ولي بين اب دي راية للدين لات جنس لي فيكس اب الساحة لي عندو ساب الحال تالفي عن من كل مار ان كنت معنا في الكليم تا تأبيدا متى كتبنا جرايتنا بالدم كلمنا كل متى سهولك زم ايدينا مرسوسة في ايديك امشي معنا في الطريق تحيتنا في شنبات نسلوهين يا
Good evening. It is a pleasure for us to welcome you here for this year's Lenten Reflection. It is so encouraging to see so many lecturers, professionals, and friends for this year's Lenten Reflections. Our guest, as you know, this year is Father Timothy Ratcliffe. So thank you very much for accepting our invitation. And it is an honor for us to be here at the university. I would like to present Father Ratcliffe to you. I know that some or most of you know Father Ratcliffe through his publications, through his books. We have some of them here for sale. Timothy was born in London in 1945. He joined the English province of the Dominican Order in 1965 and was ordained a priest in 1971. He studied at Blackfriars and at St. John's College in Oxford and in Paris. He was a chaplain to the University of London from 1974 till 1976 before returning to Oxford, where he taught scripture and doctrine for 12 years. Besides teaching and preaching, he was involved in the peace movement and the ministry to people with AIDS. He was prior of Oxford from 1982 to 1988, when he was elected provincial of the English province. In 1992, he was elected master of the order, finishing his term in 2001. He is now an itinerant preacher and lecturer based at Blackfriars, Oxford, spending half of the year traveling and on the board of the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. So he really travels around the world, I once received an email from New Zealand, another one from Peru, another one from England, so he's got a lot of experience around the world. He has honorary doctorates from various universities, and he is author of Sing a New Song on Religious Life. This afternoon we just had a very interesting talk on religious life. It was open for religious and diocesan priests. A very inspiring talk, I would say. Other books are I Call You Friends, Seven Last Words, and the recently published book, What is the Point of Being a Christian? So I would like to invite Father Ratcliffe to share his reflections with us. Thank you very much.
Given Tom. Well, at least you knew I was... One Sunday, a distraught mother went into the bedroom of her son and tried to wake him up. And she said, come on, get up. You've got to go to Mass. And 10 minutes later, there was no sign of any movement. So she went back to his room and said, come on, get up immediately. It's time to go to Mass. And he said, oh, mother. He said, why do I have to go? And she said, for two reasons. First of all, it's Sunday, and you're supposed to go to Mass on a Sunday. And secondly, because you are the bishop of the diocese. Even bishops can get bored. And I think for very many young people, there is a reluctance to get involved in the church because it is conceived of as boring. There's much more interest in God. Actually, European surveys suggest that the belief in God is growing, but people are interested more in spirituality than in religion. It's very interesting that an increasing number of young Catholics believe in paradise, whereas young Protestants believe in life after death. Don't ask me what the difference is. So what I want to look at in these three lectures is how we can share our faith with the young, how we can show that it touches their deepest desires, that it is not, in the end, boring. So tonight, I want to look at how we enter into contact with the young. How do we reach them? And here I must make a confession. Before I left Oxford, I worked hard on this lecture. I struggled with it. And just before I went to the airport yesterday, I recorded it on my memory stick, or so I thought. I had the terrible experience this morning of saying, now I must print out this evening's lecture, and finding that there was only one page. So what this means, this is the moment where I refer to you as my brothers and sisters in Christ, is if I get confused, if you don't follow me, it's not your fault. At least be reassured that tomorrow's lecture will be a bit more coherent, probably. And then tomorrow I will take the theme of freedom, develop that. I'll touch on it briefly this evening, but I'll try to explore the nature of freedom in Christ. And then on the third evening, Father Jimmy told me that I had to give a lecture on justice and peace. And I'm always obedient, not very often to the Jesuits, but in this case... So, in the third evening, I will try to look at the subject of how justice and peace also touches, if you want, our happiness. I shall do it by looking at the Our Father. So how do we share our faith with the young in ways that can convince them that it actually touches their deepest desires, that it's not boring? St. Paul, of course, I presume must be the patron saint of Malta. In fact, I've discovered earlier today that if you want to get anywhere in the church in Malta, you have to be called Paul. I met the Dominican provincial, I met the Jesuit provincial, and I met then the new archbishop, one after the other, all Pauls. So if you are ambitious and your name is Timothy, try another career. But even the great St. Paul, even the great St. Paul could be so boring that Eutyches fell asleep and fell to his death. And even in my most boring lectures, I've never yet killed anybody. Tonight might be the first time. St. Caesarius of Arles was so notoriously boring when he preached that they had to lock the doors of the church to stop anyone getting out. I asked Jimmy to do this, but apparently it's against the fire regulations. John Donne, the famous Anglican divine, he used to say, the Puritans preach for so long because they have to wait for the congregation to wake up again. So I want to think, how may we reach the young in ways that touch them and show how their faith relates to what is central to their lives. The first thing is we have to be where they are. We have to bring the gospel to where the young gather. There's an interesting book written on Christianity and Generation Y. That's people aged from 15 to 25. And they suggested that the first place that the young go, they gather, at least in England, is they go clubbing. In fact, I'm afraid to say I didn't even know what clubbing was until then. But every weekend, millions of young people go clubbing, dancing, and singing. One teenager said, I think that for us younger people who don't find much interest in the Catholic religion, we find something else that we cling to. For most of us, what we cling to is clubbing. There you find a million friends in one room. So how can we be present in that room? Or how can we be present in the pubs and the cafes where so many young people go? The Dominicans have just opened up a new international college in Louvain. So when we were looking at the plans, we installed a pub, an English pub, I'm happy to say, where the brethren are behind the bar serving beer every night. And I went there for the opening, and it was astonishing how quickly there the young people shared their basic concerns with me without even knowing I was a priest, perhaps because they didn't even know I was a priest. Or there's internet. How can we be present in that whole world of internet? The young divide us into digital immigrants and digital natives. The immigrants are people like me who visit the web from time to time. Or sport. How can we be present in the world of sport? I will give you anybody a prize who can tell me the two teams are famous football teams founded by the Dominicans. Well, you're Juventus and the other? Newcastle United. I'm happy to say that the Jesuits were present in the London Marathon this year. Didn't do very well, but the second thing is that we have to recognize the young. Jesus was above all the person who recognized people. He looked at them and he knew them. Nathanael didn't accept him. Nathanael didn't recognize Jesus. But Jesus was able to say, I saw you under the fig tree. He knew him. He spotted Levi at the tax office. The Pharisees got all indignant, but they hadn't even seen he was there. Jesus was probably the only one who spotted that woman, the widow, the insignificant poor person, putting her money in. So one of the first things you see about Jesus is that he looks at people, he sees them, and he recognizes them. William James said, "No more fiendish punishment could ever be devised, if such a thing were physically possible, that one should be turned loose in society and remain absolutely unnoticed by all the members thereof. If no one turned around when we entered and answered when we spoke or minded what we did, but if every person we met cut us dead and acted as if we were non-existent things, a kind of rage and impotent despair would before long well up in us, from which the cruelest bodily torture would be a relief." And I think there's something in that. When you know that somebody simply looks through you, ignores you, doesn't see your face, then you feel annihilated. One of the reasons I think there is so much anger against the church, I don't know about here, but in most of Europe, is not that people reject Christianity, it's because they feel consigned to invisibility. Often we talk about people. We talk about divorced and remarried people. We talk about ethnic minorities. We talk about the poor. We talk about gay people. But do we talk to them? And do we hear them when they speak? And it's this sense of not being recognized that so often creates an anger against the church. So if we are to follow in the example of Jesus, then we must see people. Recently I was in Peru, and there was an international exhibition there of photographs of street kids. And apparently under the picture of one particularly desolate child, there was a subscription written, "Saben que existo, pero no me ven." They know that I exist, but they don't see me. They know I exist as a statistic, or they know I exist as a threat, or they know I exist as a problem, but they don't see me. I think one of the biggest challenges in preaching the gospel is learning the art of seeing people's faces. Some people never actually discover how to look at the face of another person and see its beauty, see its dignity, see its sorrow, see its joy. You can't preach the gospel if you don't look at people. And that's an art that you have to learn. I was one of my brethren at Oxford. His father is called Michael Finn. He's a very famous abstract painter. All his paintings consist, virtually all, of three horizontal lines. And I had to confess that I always found them rather boring. In fact, I always thought I could do just as well myself. Give me 10 minutes, you know. And every year when I went to stay with Michael and his wife and his family, I used to dread the moment when he'd say, "Come and see my latest paintings." What could I say? Oh, three more straight lines. How surprising. But what I found was that by living with those paintings, very slowly I learnt to see them. By looking at them out of the corner of my eye at coffee in the morning, I began to be able to see them. Looking at them perhaps over a gin, if I was lucky, before dinner, slowly I became aware of their subtlety. You have to live with people and patiently see their faces. And if you really do see the face of another human being, then you will delight in it, because you will see its goodness and its dignity, whoever they are. Jesus is preaching of the gospel began with the pleasure he took in people, his delight in them. He ate and drank with them. He feasted because he saw their goodness. He saw the goodness of even the tax collectors and the prostitutes. And therefore, if we are to be preachers of the gospel and preachers to the young, first of all, we must see their faces and see who they are. And that means starting with who they claim to be. You cannot cherish the identity of anyone unless you respect the identity that they claim. You may challenge that identity eventually. You may invite them to a deeper identity, but you have to start with where they are. Yesterday, as I was coming here in the aeroplane, I read an interesting article about skinheads. Do you remember skinheads? And one young guy, he said, "They think that we are the scum of the earth, but we know differently." So you have to start with the identity that people present the young, whether it's punk or goth. That's where they are. Just as Jesus started with where people were, with the rich young man, he didn't say, "Well, I like you when you become poor." He loved him as he was, filthy rich. Therefore, he could challenge him to be more. He could say, "Come, give up all that you have and follow me." Just as with the prostitutes, he delighted in their company. He took pleasure in their humanity. They were probably rather more fun than the Pharisees. Therefore, he could invite them to go further. It reminds me of Cardinal Danielou, a great and holy man, I think a member of the Society of Jesus, who was found dead on the staircase going up to a prostitute's house. Next day, you had all the usual insinuations and rumors in the press. But those who knew him knew that he was a good man who was continuing the ministry of Jesus to the most despised people. And you do that by taking pleasure in their company. It's a great place for a cardinal to die, even an archbishop. Thirdly, you have to recognize people's values. As I say, you may challenge these values, but you must start with the values that are central in young people's lives. My guess, and I will look at three of them briefly, is that the principal ones for most young people are happiness, freedom, and truthfulness. I want to look very, very briefly at how we embrace and challenge each of those. Young people want to be happy. And this isn't surprising. St. Augustine wrote, "Everybody wants to be happy. There is no one who will not agree with me. Almost immediately the words are out of my mouth." But the happiness that young people seek is very fragile. It's threatened. Many of them are growing up, and again, I don't know Malta. I just arrived here last night. But in many places in Europe and in the world, they're growing up in the midst of violence, broken families, drug abuse, sexual abuse. And in this world, there is the imperative that they be happy. Happiness is an obligation. The one thing I dread about breakfast at Blackfriars is that when I reach for the honey pot, written on top of it are that awful word, enjoy. Like when I took off in the aeroplane last night, the pilot announces always, "Sit back, relax, and enjoy your flight." What happens if I don't want to? But in our contemporary society, happiness is an obligation. You have no right to be sad. This survey of Generation Y concludes, sadness is not easily acknowledged in the face of achievable happiness. For this reason, sadness may be a powerful source of hidden shame and loneliness for young people. One reason for the epidemic of suicides among young people all the way from Japan to Finland, even in Ireland, is that they fail to achieve sometimes the happiness that is required. Our primary witness then to the gospel is what you might call our surprising joy, our unexpected joy. There's an icon, a Russian icon of Our Lady called Our Lady of Unexpected Joy. Somebody comes to Our Lady there, distraught, in tears, and the picture shows her joy. Now, this joy isn't the forced, obligatory jollity of some Christians, particularly, if you'll excuse me, some evangelical Christians who say you must smile because Jesus loves you. I always find that profoundly depressing. It's what Seamus Heaney, the Nobel Prize winner, calls the fixed smile of those who have a pre-booked place in paradise. The joy that we offer is different from this. It's a joy which has the space for sorrow, the space for pain. I think I probably, as I told the religious earlier today, I probably owe my vocation to religious life and to the priesthood to a Benedictine great uncle of mine. He had been mutilated in the First World War, where he was a chaplain. He lost most of his fingers. He lost his eye. But he remained a supremely joyful person. And it was a joy that gave a space for his sorrow. Provided that my mother remembered to give him a large nightcap of whiskey before he went to bed each night. The abbot primate of the Benedictines, Lothko Wolff, recently invited Japanese monks, Shinto and Buddhist monks, to stay in his monastery of St. Ottilien in Germany. And after a month, they went back and he said, "What did you find interesting about your stay in our monastery?" And they replied, "The joy. Why are Catholic monks so joyful?" It's not just monks. It's all of us, if we have a touch of the beatitude for which we are made. If you look at the early Dominican preachers, people like Dominic and Jordan, Catherine of Siena, they all have as their metaphor for the gospel, the new wine that makes you drunk with joy. Actually, I think for some of them, it wasn't just a metaphor. One of the 13th century chapters said that if the brethren drink too much wine after Compline, they must say Compline all over again. But what's extraordinary about this joy, as I said, is that it creates a space for sorrow. It's large enough to contain every sorrow that you can ever know. That's why the most joyful saints are also the most sorrowful. Think of St. Francis, the joyful poverello, but the man of the stigmata. Or Dominic again, who, it is said, laughed with his brethren by day and wept with God by night. St. Francis had said, when he preached, even the fish went away happy. As a good Dominican, I ask, how can you tell a happy fish from a sorrowful one? Our joy is able to contain sorrow because it is the joy of Holy Week. which we are beginning to celebrate this now. In other words, it's a joy of a longer story, which moves, really, I suppose, from the baptism or the birth of Christ through to the resurrection. If you live in just this moment, like the so-called now generation, then the joy of this moment is complete, and the sorrow of this moment is total. You can only have a joy which is large enough for sorrow if you live in the rhythm of a longer story, a story which moves from baptism through Good Friday to Easter Sunday. The opposite of joy for a Christian isn't sorrow, it's hard-heartedness, the incapacity to feel anything at all. I discovered this when I went to Africa often. I remember during the terrible times of the genocide, the conflicts between Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda and Burundi, I used to go every year so that I could try to bring some hope and joy to our brothers and sisters. What I always found is it was they who brought joy to me. The suffering of that time demolished all superficial optimism, all easy jollity, so that either you believed, in which case you were touched with the deepest joy possible, or you despaired. And then I say a word about freedom. The European Value Study, published every 10 years, shows that the most cherished value in European young people is freedom. There are many sorts of freedom. The freedom of the consumer, who is able to choose between various forms of tomato juice in the supermarket. There is the freedom of autonomy, of which nobody is allowed to interfere in my life. I don't think, actually, that the young are materialistic. In my experience, the young are generally idealistic, extremely generous, very tolerant, open-hearted and open-minded. I think this image of the young as being just wanting money is actually quite untrue. When they do want money, it's not because they're materialistic, it's because money gives you the freedom to be who you want and to go where you want. They want money for freedom, not for its own sake. In some ways, I think this is the least materialistic generation we've had for centuries. Now, faced with this desire for freedom, as with happiness, they find themselves more controlled, more watched by more CCTV television cameras, more imprisoned and recorded than any other generation. Hence the beautiful freedom of internet. Internet where you can be whoever you want, you can talk to anybody in the world, and if they're boring, unlike with this lecture, you can just turn them off. I think if we are to reach young people, then we must recognize that hunger for freedom and show them the deeper freedom which is in Christ. So often the church is thought of as being a place of restriction, of commandments, of prohibitions, telling you what you are not allowed to do, which is usually what you really want to do. Usually, when we think of Christian morality, it's in terms of the Ten Commandments. I'm reminded of a Polish Dominican who, on the night before the Battle of Monte Cassino, suddenly found that everybody in the Polish regiment wanted to come to confession. There they were, thousands of them. What was he to do? This was before general absolution had been ever thought of, let alone forbidden. So he got them all to lie down on the ground. And he read aloud the list of the Ten Commandments. And he said, every time I get to a commandment, if you've broken that one, waggle your left foot. And with your right, indicate how many times. Our freedom, freedom in Christ, must be seen as more than my autonomy, more than my freedom from interference, more than the freedom of the consumer. Ultimately, they must see in us the crazy freedom of Christ, which is the freedom to give your life away without condition and forever, whether in marriage, whether in mission, whether in religious life, whether for some cause. One of my closest friends in the order is a French Dominican called Jean-Jacques Veronese, a Breton. And we used to study together in Paris at the Académie de la Bière. And he was trained in economics. He went to Algeria, where he taught irrigation, helped in the whole development of irrigation schemes for northern Algeria, the recovery from the Sahara. He learnt Arabic, and he was profoundly contented. And then one day he received a phone call from his provincial, which said, we want you to come back to Lyon to be the student master and to teach economics at Lyon University. And first of all, he was completely thrown. He thought, I don't want to leave this place where I'm so happy. And then he remembered the joy of freely giving his life to the order, without condition. So he went and found a bottle of champagne, not very easy in Algeria. And then he gathered his friends to celebrate the joy of giving your life, the freedom of giving your life. 3 years later, when I was elected master of the order, and I desperately wanted him on our council, I rang him up, I tracked him down in a monastery, and I said, Jean-Jacques, you wouldn't like to come and join me in Rome, would you? And he said, right. He said, could I think about this for a while? I said, of course. He said, could I take a month? I said, well, could you make it a day? And then he said, of course. I don't need a day, I'll come. More champagne. So this is the crazy freedom that we have to show, that touches and embraces the hunger for freedom that young people have. Finally, more complex, so I'll only touch on it very briefly, I'm afraid, is truth. One of the things that young people are very exigent about is that we are truthful. Truthful in the sense of authentic. Be yourself. As Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst cannot be false to anyone. Truthfulness as authenticity. No one is going to believe a word that we say about the gospel unless they see that we are authentic, that we only say what we believe, that we don't simply repeat formulas because we've heard them, and that we are unashamed to face also our doubts, our hesitations, our questions. If we try to fool people by not saying what we believe ourselves, really, myself, to be true, then we will not be credible. A little congregation of 10 very old deaf people will immediately see and know without fail that we aren't telling the truth. Barbara Brown Taylor is an American Episcopalian preacher. And she once said, I wish the preachers did not lie so much. By which she meant not that we tell blatant lies, but often We fail to be truthful about what our people live. We fail to be truthful about the struggles people have. We easily produce church language. An Irish bishop humbly confessed. He said that he gave a talk about sex and marriage. And everybody smiled. And as he walked down the aisle, he heard somebody, two women in front of him, and one of them said, "Wasn't that a beautiful sermon on sex by the bishop?" Lovely, very beautiful indeed. It's just a pity he knows so much less about it than we do. So the challenge is for us to be authentic. Pope Paul VI said, at this moment, we need witnesses more than teachers. And we are only going to be teachers if we are seen to be witnesses. So that is a challenge the young put to us. I think every time I have to face a group of young people, I have to ask, do I believe every word I'm saying? But there is a challenge that we have to put to them. We live in what has often been called a relativistic society, a society in which there is any doubt about truth claims, which are objective. This is a complex topic, and it's very close to the heart of the present Pope. But next Easter Vigil, we're all going to be invited to stand, and the creed will be read out. And it will be, we will be asked, do you believe? I do. At the heart of our faith is the belief, contrary to our society, a challenge to our society, that there are objective truths. That Jesus truly was the Son of God. That he rose from the dead. That he's seated at the right hand of the Father. We have to face, I think, the challenges of committing ourselves to truths. This, I have to confess, was at the heart of my own Dominican vocation. I was brought up by the Benedictines, as Jimmy politely failed to mention. When I left school, when I was at school, I have to confess, I was not a very pious child. In fact, I was almost expelled for reading Lady Chatterley's Lover during benediction. It was only after I left school that really I made friends with people who weren't Christians, who weren't Catholics, and the question they kept putting to me was, is it true? Is it true? And this became an obsessive question for me, until finally I remembered there was a religious order that had the motto, truth. Veritas. The trouble was I couldn't remember what order it was. I had to telephone the Benedictines, who were probably rather relieved when they said it was the Dominicans. I went and joined them. Mind you, truth isn't necessarily always that interesting. I'm reminded of the story of the man who was in a hot air balloon drifting over the south of England. And the balloon came down in a tree. And he had no idea where he was. He saw two men walking by. He said, "Help, help, where am I?" And one of them looked at him and he said, "You're in a tree." So he said, "Oh," he said, "you must be a Dominican." The chap said, "Oh, yes, how did you know?" He said, "Because what you say is completely true, but utterly useless." I think a particular challenge at this moment is how we can be people who preach the truth confidently, courageously, but not arrogantly or oppressively. At this moment, if you look around the globe, then you will find that there is tension and violence related everywhere to the clash of religious beliefs. People who claim the truth for Jesus, the Quran, for the Mahabharata, for the Torah. So we have to find a way of proclaiming the truth that is courageous, that challenges the relativism of our culture, but humbly, attentive to what we can learn from people of other beliefs and none. If you just have the courage, then you can drift into arrogance. If you just have the humility, you can find yourself in relativism. At the moment, I'm reading the life of Mahatma Gandhi, a very great man. I'm studying him so that I may learn from him. What I hope is that I may learn not only about his Hinduism, but that I may also learn about Christ. He is somebody perhaps who understood the Beatitudes better than anybody else in the 20th century. His profound non-violence, Satyagraha. In his room, there was only one picture, which in fact was of Jesus. And it said, "He is our peace." So when we engage in dialogue, it's because we trust that the other person will have something to receive from us, but also that we will have something to receive from them. So happiness, freedom, and truth. But what I would suggest is that we have to offer those in ways that are puzzling and bizarre, because we offer a happiness which is large enough for sorrow, and we offer a freedom which is vast enough to give a place for our surrender of our lives, to giving our lives away in what looks like apparent unfreedom, as you give your life to another person in marriage, a cause, or religious life. And also a truth which is big enough for the truth of other people. If you respect the truth of Christ, who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," then he has a space for any truth, any human truth that we may encounter. Thank you very much.
Have time for a question?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
In a couple of minutes' time, we'll be able to put our questions to Father Ratcliffe, so we'll spend some time buzzing about his delivery tonight. Thank you. I just wanted to tell you that we are recording Father Timothy's reflections, so just for you to know that even the questions and answers will be recorded. Thank you.
I hope you won't find that as intimidating as I do. But just remember the golden rule: there are no stupid questions. There are only stupid answers.
Uh, Father, last Saturday's church-inspired newspaper ran a headline, people who have undergone a sex change cannot get married within the church. I call this as one instance of, you know, our concern with truths, but at the same time, bringing out the problem of how to reach out to people like this. Thank you.
Presumably, if they both had sex changes, there wouldn't be a problem. I think always the first thing is you have to engage with people in friendship. This is an issue, I must admit, of which I know really very, very little, and one that is highly disputed. But I think you can say nothing until you actually enter into friendship with somebody. I think it's only when you are with them that you might discover what it is right to say. Often, you know, when we're meditating upon some complex moral issue, we think about it in the privacy of our heads. But I think Thomas Aquinas said that ethics is a practical science. And if it's a practical science, it has to be rooted in prudence. Prudence is not, for Aquinas, being very cautious. I heard of a woman, of a family in Manchester, who had three children called Faith, Hope, and Prudence. Prudence is being in touch with the real world. So I think when we think of these moral issues, the first thing is we have to get in touch with what they actually live. What do they feel? What have they experienced? And then, in friendship, we may discover what to say. I'm very weary. I think that it was only really after the Reformation, when Christianity became much more militant, that ethics ceased to be a practical science and it became an abstract science, where you start from abstract principles and then you deduce what must be the case without actually listening to what any poor chap actually lives. So that's the first step for me. Get ethics down to earth again.
You talked about the use of people communicating with one another openly. Do you think that in the university curriculum, where at present there is such a lot of emphasis on being value-free.
On what?
Being value-free. Mm-hmm. Somehow, in the academic world, very often values are considered as not to be part of the academic world. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that in the academic curriculum there are ways in which to somehow teach the values of communicating deeply and authentically and in a non-violent way?
It's a very interesting question. It's certainly been the prejudice. I'm not a philosopher, as anybody would quickly see, but there's certainly been the prejudice in one branch of British philosophy that facts and values are entirely different things. This is beginning to be challenged, I think, thanks be to God. So I think it's an artificial and implausible dichotomy. What I would say is one of the first things, and I don't know the experience of this university, is that we have to show that within the faculty, the members of the faculty are able to talk frankly and openly about values among themselves. I remember when I first went to Oxford, a very, very long time ago, I remember the first time I was invited to dine on high table. I imagined this brilliant interchange, witty conversation, startling insights, and I found that they were just as backbiting as everybody else. And I think very often, in my experience, and I've been involved in quite a number of different universities in different continents, in the States, in Britain, in Italy, and elsewhere, in Australia, that actually there's very often a fear of real dialogue even between members of the faculty. And it's partly because we are competitive. And we can feel very, very vulnerable. If I have my pet theory, the theory about which I've written 83 almost identical articles, then I'm highly vulnerable to critique. And so I think what we have to do is in our universities cultivate the real humility of those who can hear people who differ from themselves. Simone Weil, the French mystic, she said, at the heart of real genius is a humility of mind. And it's very rare in universities. Well, not always very common in religious life either. But and then we will dare to face these issues of value. I think in ethics, one of the most encouraging things, actually, for a recovery of a good language of values has been the renaissance of thinking of virtues. I think the return to virtue theories for ethics is actually beginning to bear fruits in many places, in many universities, in our discussion about fundamental values.
Thanks. My question, in a sense, follows on from the previous one. In today's world, in today's Europe, how do you see the way the church or the way a believer can put forward truth when confronted with a world that looks for facts, for scientific evidence? That, as I read it, there is a risk that we say, this is something you experience within. This is something you can't really explain. But really, if what we believe in is true, we should be able to explain it in a way that today's world that puts so much store by reason can accept. And I think this is a challenge that the church today faces, and one that I believe it finds hard to deal with. The Bishop of Durham maybe springs to mind, but anyway.
It certainly was the issue that was at the forefront of Pope Benedict's speech at Regensburg. Because what was at issue was unfortunate, that remark about the Byzantine emperor, which caused such a lot of conflict. But the Pope was making a very important point, which was that we've tended to narrow down our understanding of reason. If you look at somebody like Aquinas, or Anselm, or really any of the great theologians, their understanding of the nature of ratio, reason, was very broad. Reason included aesthetic reason, for example. It included all the ways in which we seek to understand our experience. What has tended to happen, I think perhaps in recent centuries, is that we've narrowed down our conception of reason to scientific reason. Scientific reason is absolutely authentic and valid within its own terms and must be respected, but it is only, if you want, one form of reasoning. It's one of the many ways in which we try to make sense of the world. And I think what we have to do, this is what the Pope was inviting us to do at Regensburg, is we have to recover that larger sense of reason. Just to give one small example. When we try to understand what we live, even a scientist won't only do this in scientific language. If he or she falls in love, lives through failure, faces suffering or death, then other sorts of forms of understanding will be necessary. One of the ways, for me personally, one of the ways that I find most illuminating in trying to understand, to see the world clearly, is through novels and films. These are interpretive skills where you try to find the appropriate categories for what people actually live, the real dramas of their lives. Scientific facts are fine. But Alistair MacIntyre said scientific facts weren't invented till the 17th century, like men's wigs and telescopes. In fact, they were quite related to the invention of the telescope. So what we have to actually do is not reject science at all. We must recognize its validity within that much larger sphere of reason by which people struggle to make sense of their lives. Cornelius Ernst, who was a man who influenced me very greatly, he said, theology is how we make sense of the world in the light of the gospel, and of the gospel in the light of the latest disciplines and sciences that we have. There's always this mutual to and fro. Try to understand modernity, criticize it in the light of the gospel, but also trying to understand the gospel in the light of the latest sciences, psychology, anthropology, philosophy, whatever it is.
Many times we've always been told about religious having freedom. Today you came up with an expression, freedom for married people. What are you referring to there? Could you explain that a bit more, please?
What I mean is you have to be very brave to give yourself a marriage to somebody else, or to give yourself to a religious order, or to give yourself to a cause. It requires courage. And I think in Malta, perhaps, you're still blessed with a great tradition of marriage. Now, in England, you find increasingly people don't get married because they're too frightened. They're frightened to commit themselves to another person. They're frightened that they might fail. They're frightened, I think sometimes they might be too known. I mean, you can tell me more about what it's like being married to Maria, but when you're married to somebody, they get to know you very well. They get to know you better, perhaps, sometimes than you might immediately want. It's the same in religious life. If you live with your brothers and they love you, they will soon know a great deal more about you. And that requires courage. And that's what I mean by the freedom. It's the freedom to say, okay, it may be frightening, it may be a risk, it may require tremendous courage on my part, but I'm free to do it. I think engaging in any great cause requires that freedom. I think of an example which I like is of a young Englishman, half English, half Australian, called James Maudsley. He became obsessed by the tyranny in Burma. And he decided when he was 18 he would give his life to resisting the tyranny. So he went to the capital, Rangoon, and he chained himself to the gates of the government building and distributed pamphlets. How he did that while he was chained, I'm not quite sure. But and of course soon he was arrested. The next day, the British ambassador came and said, "You've been a silly boy, don't do it again." Put him on an aeroplane, flew him back to Britain. 6 months later, he was back. This time, he was imprisoned for 6 months in solitary confinement. And then the ambassador, you know, our British ambassadors are jolly good. I don't think the Australian ambassador would have managed it. Got him out, got him back to England. A year later, he was back again. I forget how long he was in prison this last time. But he had the freedom to give himself. When everybody else said, don't do it, it's crazy, you'll only get hurt. That's the sort of, I suppose, courageous freedom I mean.
Okay. So outside, on one side, you'll find the store selling Figoli. The reason we're selling it is not to become another market outside the temple, but to gather some funds for people who are going up to Egypt, for the poor people whom we shall be working with in Egypt. So the funds will go for the poor. On the other side, you'll find the store selling books. Those books are provided for us by Preka Library in Blat al-Bayda. We have a very small selection, obviously, of their larger selection. Unfortunately, Father Timothy Ratcliffe's books are still on their way from America, and they shall come. I don't know why they come from there. So they'll arrive after he leaves. But that will make his presence with us last longer, I suppose. So you'll be able to get most of his books from Preka Library after the Lenten season is over. But there are other books, obviously, which you can relish throughout the Easter season. Thank you. We'll see you again tomorrow at 7:30. Vince will close up this song.
L-għonet grazzi l-Fader Jimmy u l-komunità u nek li stidnuni biex ikkun magħhom ukoll f'xi kanzunetti u fil-fazzena għala din is-sezzjoni, kanzunetta li hija bbażata fuq il-diskors tal-muntanja ta' Kristu propju li semma Fader Timothy. Jisimha Ħenin.
Ħenin il-foqra f'qalbhom għax is-saltna imwedin, ħenin dawk għall-ħaq imġewħa għax fis-saltna imberkin. Mill-imħabba imċaħdin, ħenin dawk li ġejtum ċanfra, ħabba sewa imwarbin. Kantawum lew għalbkom bil-fer, għax ħlaskom kbir fis-sema jkun. Ħenin dawk li ġew imkasbra għax fis-saltna imfaħri. Ħenin jekk spajtum bikma għax fis-saltna imsabri. Ħenin dawk li ġew minn sija għax għas-saltna mażuli.
Grazie a tutti.